So whether it's a co-op, whether it's a union, whether it's a church, there's lots of different spaces where people are able to connect across difference. Those are important spaces for creating common cause and community. That's the work of organizing. It's not expecting folks to be perfect, but to find common bounds. And that's the central value of solidarity. What we want for ourselves, we want for all.
Hey everyone, it's Hilde, and this is the Creating the Future podcast. I'm glad you've joined us here today. This is a place for us to explore what really creates social change. And it feels like these days that conversation is more important than ever. All around the world, we're witnessing attacks on the gains of decades of social justice efforts. And yet we changemakers are taking action, organizing to counter those attacks, marching in the streets, calling our legislators, organizing boycotts. That brings us full circle to the single question at the heart of this podcast, perhaps a more important question now than ever. What actually creates social change? I couldn't think of someone better to talk about organizing for change than today's guest, Steve Dubb. Steve has been involved in social movement organizing for pretty much his whole life. Having spent over a decade focused on building community wealth at the Democracy Collaborative, Steve is currently the senior editor for economic justice at Nonprofit Quarterly. When I talk with Steve, I'm reminded of the power of organizing, building on the power that average people don't even realize they have until they band together. And so it is my pleasure to welcome Steve Dubb to the podcast today. Welcome to the podcast, Steve. It is so wonderful to have you with us today. I've been looking forward to our conversation.
Thank you for having me.
You have been involved in social change efforts and initiatives for decades. Can you just share a little bit about what is it in your life that led you to be so passionate about social change?
That's an interesting question. I think it was in the genes, partially. I come out of a Jewish social justice tradition, secular, I should add. One of the stories in my family was about my great-grandmother when her husband died, mixing the dishes the following day. So it was definitely not a religious Jewish family. She was an ILG organizer. She was a personal acquaintance of Jean Debs, the leader of the rail workers, and of course ran as the socialist for president, including once from prison. He was jailed for protesting World War I, but he would give out warm coats in Chicago during the winter. And as an ILG steward, my great-grandmother was responsible for getting him those coats to give out, among other things. So it goes back pretty far. I could go a lot more into my family history and my grandmother and what have you. So I just grew up with that notion that social justice was important, and this has motivated much of my life. So there you go.
It's in your DNA.
Yeah, there have been times I've tried to run away from it for sure, but yes.
It's not always easy work, but it is the work that we need to be doing. In your experience, what have you seen, Steve? What makes an impression on you of what is it that actually creates change? What is happening when real change, transformational change, actually happens?
I don't know if there's a specific transformative moment. Sometimes there is. Sometimes there can be a moment that happens that has repercussions that weren't anticipated at the time. I'll give you a story because that's probably the easiest way to do this. I was in graduate school. I was part of these worker collectives or cooperatives that existed at the University of California, San Diego campus. That's where I went to graduate school. And we were running textbook stores and a food co-op, and there was a vegetarian restaurant. Pretty remarkable, pretty unusual in the U.S. context. There's a reason why these existed at UC San Diego. UC San Diego, not known particularly as a lefty campus, but there were some key people there. Herbert Marcuse was there in the early days, the famous Marxist philosopher. He had a student who you might have heard of named Angela Davis. And so these co-ops came to be. And they came to actually be financially successful, which then became, strangely enough, you know, back in the days when universities used to own their own bookstores, a financial threat to the university in some small way. And so the university tried to eliminate these cooperatives. They actually shut off the power at one point. They broke and entered into the general store co-op, which was like the least political of the co-ops. They sold healthy things like cigarettes and candy bars and what have you, right? So I remember getting calls. We had a phone tree back then. There weren't cell phones back in the early 1990s. So I remember getting a call like at 2 a.m. and coming to campus. And we were initially locked out. They had an emergency key, the university. And their vice chancellor of student affairs with a few police officers, campus police, went in looking for accounting records that weren't there because this had been like an escalating conflict. So they changed the locks. And so the staff had to break in a window to get into their own store. And we did that and then changed the locks back, opened for business as usual. And then the police came in that morning, the campus police, to be clear. Right. And pushed folks out. And so then you had people banging on the window. We activated all our phone trees of supporters on campus. This had been an escalating conflict. And you had hundreds of people by noon around this general store co-op banging on the windows, saying the revolutionary slogan, "Hey, Tommy." Tommy Tucker was the vice chancellor of student affairs at the time. "Hey, Tommy, give me a Coke." So that was the revolutionary slogan, which is to say it wasn't a revolutionary slogan, but it had a transformative effect. We got a restraining order from the judge the next day, banning the university from entering the store on the campus. And it changed the culture of that campus. Was anybody intending any of this? No. Was it social justice oriented? Co-ops were social justice oriented. It was about self-management and what have you. But was there a social justice agenda here? Not really.
How did it change the culture of the campus? I'm curious, in what ways?
Well, it made the co-ops from something that was this tradition that had been around for 15, 20 years, but not really thought about, into an institution that still exists. They're still there. Now on tours, oh, well, you're the co-ops. So that was a culture-building moment. We did a lot of work. We had facts. I was doing press relations at the time. I was sending faxes, because that's what you did in the early 1990s, to all the TV folks. We had all that prepared. We had done what we called dorm storming, or which is door-to-door organizing on campus. It wasn't just magic how you end up with 500 people around the store within an hour of a break-in. But it also was not planned. I work for nonprofit quarterlies these days. Right. And you're supposed to have your theory of change. You've heard that phrase?
Absolutely. We all have.
And so often, that's not how change occurs.
And it really sounds like a story of organizing, because at the core, maybe the co-op's intention was not social justice. Maybe that wasn't at the core of it. But at the core, you could not have gathered 500 people in an instant if you were not doing that kind of organizing.
No, absolutely. I mean, the mission of the co-ops was social justice oriented. I don't want to say it wasn't. Mm-hmm. But the 500 people there just wanted to get their Coke and cigarettes and whatever else. A lot of the people we were organizing were, not to put a political spin on it, but I didn't ask people what their political affiliation was, but safe to say half the students there were Republican. This was not some lefty thing. The people in the co-ops might have had a left politics. Certainly, like at Groundwork Books, we had an avowedly socialist politics. That wasn't how we made the money. We made money by selling textbooks for classes, but for our general stock, the books that were on the shelves, there was very much a politics, and we had speakers and all sorts of things that we did. So we were very conscious of our politics, but we were operating really in kind of a defensive struggle because we were actually being potentially forced off of campus. I'm not kidding that they shut off power. So that was what we were facing. So yes, we certainly had a social justice point of view, belief system, systems of political education, all of that. But it wasn't some brilliant plan to change the culture of the university in that way. This was really a defensive survival struggle. Right. We didn't win that battle. But the notion of what the university was, who it was, what its core values were, shifted, and shifted in ways that nobody could have planned.
Why do you think it turned out that way? What do you think led to that shift?
So one of the things about co-ops, and of course, a lot of my life since then has been involved with cooperatives, it taps into certain values of self-governance, self-reliance, doing for yourself that have a broad echo on the campus, certainly, but I think, you know, more broadly. This is why you can see co-op organizing often succeeding in places that are quote unquote red states. So we tapped into that too. UCSD at the time, not a conservative campus, but definitely not a particularly left campus by anybody's estimation. I mean, San Diego is a military town,
right.
Naval center. And so it wasn't that everyone shared our politics, certainly, but it was that people like respected the ability of a small group of people to actually put together something like a store that could do $1 million in sales a year and be successful at that and not just be part of the university bureaucracy. So that resonated with a lot of people. And I think we sort of fed into some of the, I don't know, underdog narratives, I guess I would call it, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really getting this sense of the big guys clamping down on the little guys.
Yeah, it was definitely that.
Well,
they were using the power
of
the state against,
you
know, it's kind of ironic, right? They were using the power of the state against these small businesses.
Well,
that doesn't
you know,
sound like a left-wing thing, right?
No, it doesn't until you look behind it and you look at the fact that you already had a phone tree in place. So you were ready for something like this.
To some degree, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I can't help but think of how often minds shift when we see people of power, of ascribed power, clamping down on others. It's clearly what led to the uprising after George Floyd's murder. You look at the sense we had that this wasn't just wrong, it was the abuse of power. And you saw the same thing during the civil rights movement, when on our televisions at night, you watched the abuse of power. There's something in seeing it and visually seeing it or being part of it that I think shifts us, changes us.
It does in certain circumstances, certainly. I mean, I was a freshman in college at UC Berkeley, so more conventional liberal campus, I suppose. In the spring of 1986, the university called in the police. So people think what happened with the Palestinian protests this past year was like unusual. Unfortunately not. There's a fine tradition of suppression on campuses. So this was in the spring of 86, and they brought in the campus police and Alameda County police and Oakland police and San Francisco police.
Right.
There were hundreds of police there. They filled up two buses. They still had more people blocking the campus. I happened to be one of them. And they just took out nightsticks and started beating everybody. That is what happened. And it worked. I mean, the protest worked. The Republican governor later that spring or early summer was running for re-election, and he got enough trustees of the public university to vote to divest from South Africa. So the campaign was successful. In fact, beyond belief, because it didn't just affect the university's assets, it actually led to the state assets. And eventually there was federal legislation, as you know, that passed over Reagan's veto to put sanctions on, say, South Africa. So the movement was successful. We were just a small part of it, of course. But you do not forget, it's something that shapes your life. I just turned 19 then.
Yeah. When we watched the aggression against the protesters regarding Palestine, all I kept thinking of was Kent State. So it is not new. It is not unusual. Watching folks be, and I keep using that term, clamped down upon, because that's really what it feels like.
Yeah. do we really know what causes social change in that sense? I don't know, because obviously sometimes the sad truth is often repression is effective, right? Sometimes it's failed spectacularly. It did at Kent State. It did at Berkeley in 86. So there are many times when state repression can backfire, but there's also many times when this is the less happy part of it, where it's successful. You have to be able to hold both of those things, I think.
I'm really keying on all of the examples that you've shared so far. It's the power of seeing that oppression in reality, in the bodily harm against humans, mm-hmm. in the things that we all as humans, for the most part, hold dear. And I know in my lifetime, I've watched things shift when people can see it or hear a story and say, I never thought about it like that. And that's so much of the work that you're doing right now at Nonprofit Quarterly, is really opening those minds. We right now have a schism in the media where many folks are simply not seeing, because it's not being reported on the media they happen to watch, are not really seeing the full picture of what's going on. But the work that you're doing is really about helping folks to see what is really going on. It sounds like that's a thread through a lot of what you've experienced.
I think it's kind of like it's seeing, but it's also how do you define, I don't know, your circle of concern is the sort of cliche term. But sometimes people do broaden their circle of concern, think of a broader community, and sometimes they shut themselves off. And usually you find people in both groups, but that's the challenge. It's not just communication, it's communication across difference. It can happen, does happen, has happened. So it's not like some kind of Pollyannish, this can never occur. We've seen it so many times in our history, but it certainly doesn't always occur and can't be taken for granted. So it's a challenge always. It's an organizing challenge.
It definitely is. Are there stories that come to mind for you of places where you've seen people come to that understanding across differences?
Sure. You mentioned the response after the George Floyd murder. That was part of multiple instances of state violence. Let's not ignore that. People who were wrongly murdered, whether it's Tamir Rice or there's so many, right? Breonna Taylor. So these stories interconnected, but you did see responses to those earlier instances as well that were kind of like that co-op example is giving. There were smaller incidents that preceded the mass movement. And there was obviously months worth of protests in Ferguson, Missouri back in 2014. We could look at Cleveland, New York City, all sorts of places where these movements, unfortunately, the violence occurred and the movements occurred and they built on each other. So they were in correspondence with each other. So there are lots of examples where that occurs. You know, those are important spaces for creating common cause and community. So whether it's a co-op, whether it's a union, whether it's a church, synagogue, mosque, there's lots of different spaces where people are able to connect across difference. One of the challenges we face right now is that people are more isolated. And, you know, that's been written about a lot too. I think about Robert Putnam and Bowling Alone and stuff like that. So those common spaces are in some ways less significant than they used to be. And that's part of the challenge of the current moment is rebuilding.
Now you mentioned unions. So many workplaces that are organized and people standing behind their union, those individual workers may be on the left, maybe on the right, they may be Democrats, they may be Republicans. The thing they have in common is the work environment that they're experiencing. And right. I'm sensing from what you're saying, the importance of finding that common thread. The common thread on the campus was people wanted their cigarettes and their Coke. And it didn't matter where they were politically. They wanted what they wanted. There's something in what you're talking about that is finding that piece, that common thread.
Yes, absolutely. And that can be a challenge. I think it was the Romans, right, who developed a divide and conquer, right? So it was probably before the Romans, actually, but the Romans are famous for it. And so when you're doing social movement organizing in the direction, we'll say, of equity and equality, you're not the only actor on the field. And I think it's fair to say people are neither saints or devils. Most of us, myself included, have aspects of both. So that's kind of the work of organizing. It's not expecting folks to be perfect, but to find common bounds and just to make the case through the community itself, in a sense, by build the existence of the community becomes the evidence for its value at some level. The existence of the union becomes the evidence for its value, the existence of co-op does, so forth. That's kind of how organizing, when it does work.
Talk a little bit more about that, that the existence of the entity proves the reason that it needs to be there.
Yeah, presumably there's some kind of mission that is guiding, that's bringing people together. They're not just joining a co-op for the hell of it. Unions are a little more complicated because sometimes you basically pay union dues as by virtue of the contract, but that union had to be created out of nothing. And people gave up a lot. Like some people gave up their lives, right, to be in unions. People in Flint, Michigan lived in a factory for over a month, sees the tool dies, right, to get the United Auto Workers recognized. So didn't go home for over a month. So these things were not easy. And it was based on the fact that there was a community at the workplace and a desire for fairer treatment that wasn't going to be achieved individually, but only together. And that's the central bet or value of solidarity. What we want for ourselves, we want for all.
Yeah, I'd really never thought about that phrase that you use, that the existence of the entity proves the need for the entity. I'm thinking about just the existence of a food bank. You would not build a food bank. You would not fund a food bank. You would not work at a food bank if it wasn't needed. It's just a fascinating way to look at it. I'm also struck by the degree to which so many of the different examples that you've shared require sacrifice of some kind. They require sacrifice of your bodily wellness if you're being beat upon with billy clubs. They require sacrifice of whether it's union dues. Or There's a degree of sacrifice in what you're talking about.
When I think of social change, yes, I tend to think of it in terms of like these movements. And I think these movements are important when we're talking about whether it's democracy, economic justice, racial justice, health and climate justice, all the different things that we cover. Often there is an element of struggle. Often there is an element of sacrifice. Often there's an element of risk.
I know that a lot of your work has been around economic change. You run the Economy Remix at Nonprofit Quarterly. A lot of your background is in economic change. How does that relate to what we've been talking about?
Quite a bit, I think. We inhabit a capitalist economy. We act as if that's the way the world always was. But in fact, capitalism is an invention, social invention. Maybe you can date it back to the 18th century. You could argue further back, but there was always markets. That's different. But the idea that your position in society was determined on whether you had access to capital, that is to say, you could live off your investments without working for a living or not, being dependent on a wage for a living, I think that's pretty central to a lot of things in our society. Like, you know, Woodard and Bernstein, when they were writing about Watergate, and they talked to Mark Felt, who was the assistant director of the FBI, who became known as Deep Throat. And he said, follow the money. He wasn't making some major theory about Marx's economics. He was talking about the importance of economics in terms of how politics works, regardless of how you think of classes. And so in the current moment, where did Elon Musk go first? Oh, right. He went to the treasury system for their bill payments. Why is that? So we know that how we sustain ourselves is through the allocation of resources. The economy means management of our collective home. That is the oikonomos, right, of the two Greek words that make up economy. So yeah, how we manage our collective home, I think, is at the heart of so many issues of social justice, clearly in the heart of climate justice. But yeah, once you look at the economy itself, obviously, but also race relations, health. We live in a society right now in the United States where your position within the economy determines your life expectancy. It's kind of a stunning fact. So the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has done these maps. You look at the Cleveland Clinic, a major nonprofit institution, by the way. Largest employer in the city of Cleveland, more than 30,000 employees in a city of less than 500,000, right? And if you're right next door to it, right next door in like Fairfax or something, like a neighborhood like that, right? 64-year life expectancy. Near one of the top hospitals in the world. You go 5-10 miles away to Lyndhurst, wealthy suburb east of Cleveland, 88-year life expectancy. 24-year difference. And that's not just about access to health care. Of course, it's food, livelihoods, environmental poisons, all sorts of things go into that. Violence, all sorts of reasons why people live less long. But those are dramatic differences. And you can go to any city in the United States and maybe you won't find a 24-year gap, but you'll find a 10, 12, 15-year gap between wealthy areas and poor areas. And that's extraordinary. And it speaks to how much our economic position actually does matter in society. It's not just about whether you have nice things. It's literally a matter of life and death.
I think that's why so many of the movements for systems change within our society are, for lack of a better phrase, poor people's movements. The labor movement, the civil rights movement, the bus boycott started with a bus boycott.
Right.
We're looking at economics as a tool for social change. I never really thought about it like that until you started talking about it. But you're really talking about economics as a tool for social justice.
Marshall Ganz talks about this. He just had a book out recently. He's a Harvard professor now, but I won't hold that against him. He worked with Cesar Chavez for a number of years, right. Farm Workers Union, right? He was an organizer by trade. He talked about organizing in Montgomery. You know, there's a difference between power and resources. So part of the idea is that you can convert things that aren't usually resources into resources. So in Montgomery, the bus boycott, the feet were made into a resource because you were walking and you weren't going on that bus. It became a powerful resource that actually sank the city bus company, and they had to eventually concede. Grapes aren't usually a resource, but in the case of the grape boycott, they were. So identifying where you have leverage and then organizing around that leverage is really a key strategy for often for social change.
Yeah. One of the things that I've been noticing in this current atmosphere of attack on nonprofits across the U.S., is the fact that there are so many assets nonprofits have that we don't realize that we have. I'm thinking specifically of the fact that living in scarcity makes you think that you have nothing. And You talked about, I love that that vision of their feet as the asset. We don't think of that. We think of, I'm poor, I'm Black, I have no power in this current environment, I have nothing. And what the civil rights movement showed us was the power of people who thought they had nothing and who systematically we had taken a lot of things from them. I think about that in terms of the assets that nonprofits have. And many change makers, it doesn't have to be nonprofit, have when, again, living in that scarcity mode, we don't think we have anything. But we have the skills of strategic planning and community building and convening, and we don't even think of those as assets. And I think that's a big part of what you're really talking about here.
Completely true. Completely true. Last I looked, and there are numbers that will back this up, there are more people employed by nonprofits in the United States than all manufacturing companies combined.
Yep.
Yeah. It's the third largest sector. Construction's the largest, and maybe hospitality. I don't know. But it's very, very large. It's close to 10% of employment. Nonprofits are close to 6% of gross domestic product. Very powerful, very large portion of the economy have a lot of implicit economic power. Of course, it's just the tax status at some level. If you think nonprofits don't compete against each other.
Of course, of course. Well, we're forced to, so we have no choice.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and this is also an important thing. We're in a control structure, nonprofits are. And I often talk about Dean Spade's work, if you know him. He's a law professor at Seattle University in Washington State, also a major LGBTQ activist. He talks about the need for self-resourcing. We're seeing why he was saying that.
Yeah.
With all the stuff going on with freezing of grants, like building financial capacity outside, there are things you cannot do in the nonprofit sector. This is going to sound like a really trivial thing, but I'll name it. So in the nonprofit sector, I work for Nonprofit Quarterly. We are not allowed to write editorials for political candidate. That would be a violation of our nonprofit status.
Right.
Any nonprofit publication, like NPR or what have you.
Right.
After the civil rights movement, there were all these community development corporations founded. All the self-reliant stuff I talked about earlier, there's great, great people in these groups. I love CDCs and CDFIs. And it's also true that this was partially a control strategy. Let's give these folks grants and get them out of the streets. That was, in fact, what so-called liberal foundations like the Ford Foundation were doing. There's like plenty of evidence behind this. This is why people talk about the nonprofit industrial complex, and they are not wrong. There's no way you can operate in any system outside. Like the idea that there's like this pure spot where I can like critique the system and not be part of it at the same time does not exist. But it is a challenge, and it's part of what makes it so hard for nonprofits in particular to stand up in the current moment. I remember talking not that long ago with Adrienne Marie Brown, and she's like, sometimes your political home can't be your nonprofit. Sometimes it has to be something outside of it. Sometimes it can be your nonprofit. So sometimes it's helpful for like social change work to have, say, one foot within the system and one foot outside the system, and sometimes being able to use those non-system resources to organize because you have fewer resources, perhaps in a financial sense, but more freedom to do what needs to be done to actually build.
What kinds of non-organizational systems come to mind?
Well, there's many. Any kind of mutual aid type network can be that. Oh, it can be the cliche Robert Putnam thing. It could be your bowling league. It could be a church club. It could be an affinity group. So affinity groups, not like you're not incorporated, right?
Right.
You may be all working at the same nonprofit, or maybe not. Maybe this is something in your community, or you all play bridge together, or swap music, or whatever you do. So there are many, many social spaces. Sometimes they're called third spaces. And sometimes you need that legal status. Why do you need that legal status? Well, maybe you're raising money because of that legal status. I mean, there's all sorts of reasons you do. And some things you may want to do outside of that legal status. It's just you don't want to have that lever being able to be used against you oh, okay, if you say this, then we're going to take money from your nonprofit. Well, if you're not doing it as the nonprofit, you're somewhat shielded sometimes.
Yeah, there's power. There's definitely power in that. And there's also the sort of chilling effect of folks who say, because you're not allowed to endorse a candidate, who say, we're not allowed to do any advocacy work.
Right, that's not true.
Right, of course, yeah, of course. Yeah. And yet that becomes the, oh, well, we're not allowed to do advocacy, when in fact there is a vast field of advocacy that we are able to do without endorsing a candidate.
Yeah, it can be even more complicated. Like, the law is ambiguous, and it doesn't generally favor the people without power.
I think that's in general. We can do is just stop with a period there.
So what do I mean by that? Well, like, you know, what counts as electioneering? You would think it would just be a pure endorsement. But if you, like, say we're a publication and we published somebody who we interviewed and that was considered sympathetic to a specific candidate, sure, we're not endorsing them, but we are, like, platforming.
Giving them a platform.
Does that count? Probably not, but could it? And so people err on the side of, Schneider's talked about this famously about, like, don't comply in advance, but it's right. Often what gets called compliance in advance is also making sure that you don't have legal exposure. It's the same behavior in both cases, how you right. label it.
Right. I'm wondering, as we wrap up here, and this has just been such a wonderfully wide-ranging conversation, I so appreciate it. I'm wondering if there is any specific thing that you would like our listeners to take away that is something that they can do, especially in this moment right now, some action that they can take towards creating the kind of organized change that you're really talking about here.
Well, this isn't original, so I'm going to give Adrienne credit.
Good.
Adrienne Marie Graham credit. But find a political home. Find your community. And your community could be like the Democratic Socialists of America or something like that. But it could also be your local bowling club or church or what have you. Find people. Don't be isolated. That's probably like the most important thing.
Clearly the through line of everything that you've been sharing with us today. I so appreciate your time today, Steve, and this has been a wonderful conversation. I look forward to our continuing it.
All right. Thank you for the invitation.
I'm so grateful to Steve for sharing his observations with us. Thinking about movements and organizing can sometimes feel foreign to folks who haven't been involved in that work before. Our culture favors working within organizations. But what Steve is talking about is very different from that. It's about finding the strengths we have as people and then joining together with others to build on our collective strengths. At the core, that's truly what movements and organizing are all about. I loved Steve's way of seeing feet as a resource. During the civil rights movement, the folks in Montgomery, Alabama, refused to ride city buses as a protest against segregation. At the time, 75% of Montgomery's bus riders were African American. The first day after church leaders encouraged their congregations to boycott, an estimated 40,000 Black riders started walking instead of riding, and they did so, rain or shine, for a full year. If you've been thinking, I'm just one person, what can I do? It's clear that adding one person to one more person to get another person, that's really what organizing is all about. And as Steve noted, it all starts with finding who else in your community cares about the things you care about and joining them. Once again, we're reminded of the power of collective enoughness, that together we have everything we need. That is the power of organizing that's been such a part of Steve's whole life. You can learn more about Steve's work at the podcast page for this episode. And of course, if this episode got you thinking, we hope you'll share this podcast with your friends and colleagues and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, you can learn more about Creating the Future's work at creatingthefuture.org. Thank you for being with us today and for wanting to create a better future for our world. We'll see you next time here at Creating the Future.